I want to read just a few verses in the letter to the Hebrews and chapter 4. I really want to spend some time thinking about the word rather than lecturing on a particular theme. And the letter to the Hebrews is written really to encourage us and to exhort us to perseverance. So let's read in Hebrews 4 at verse 14. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. I'm sure these words are familiar to us all. In many ways, they summarize, I think, the whole teaching of this great epistle, which calls itself a word of exhortation. And we're asked to listen to the word of exhortation, and we're asked to think about Jesus, to consider him who is the apostle and high priest of our confession. So I really want to do that this morning as God enables us. And I want to think through some of the great themes of these three verses. On the one hand, the writer tells us here about what we have, and then he tells us about what we ought to do in the light of what we have. So there's the great indicative, we have a great high priest, and so on. And then there's the twofold exhortation, let us. We have, let us. In the light of what we have, let us hold fast our confession. Let us draw near to the throne of grace. And I want to think, first of all, about our possession and then about the twofold exhortation. What do we have? What do we have as Christians? Well, says the writer, we've got a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. And in connection with what we have, our possession, there are three things highlighted there. There is the person of whom he is speaking. We have a person, Jesus, the Son of God. And then there is his office. We have this person in the capacity of a great high priest. And then we've got the place that he occupies now as one who has passed through the heavens. So our attention is drawn to who this is and what he is and where he is. And these three things together are the basis for our encouragement to persevere in the faith. There's first of all the person, who this is. We have Jesus, the Son of God. And of course, the title itself is significant because on the one hand, our attention is drawn to the fact that this person is the Son of God. And therefore, every attribute of deity belongs to him. He is, to use the words of chapter 1, the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. If you were to take this person and examine his character and examine all that is attributable to him, you would find nothing except what belongs to God. All the divine attributes are his. He is from everlasting to everlasting. The infinitude of God is his infinitude. The unchangeableness of God is his unchangeableness. The glory of God is his glory. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was both with God and was and is God. And so there is nothing in God that is not in Jesus. He is the God of the Scriptures. There is no God apart from him. There is no God beside him. There is no God above him. He is the one who himself is equal with God. That's why he calls God his Father and says, I and the Father are one. So he's the Son of God. Everything in God is in him. But the remarkable thing is that the Son of God has the name of a man. He's the Son of God with a name that designates him the Son of Mary. He's called Jesus, the Son of God. Jesus is not his name because of any divine attribute. Jesus is his name because, in addition to all his divine attributes, he takes our nature, and there are now things that are true of him that were never true of him as God alone. So he is God, and yet being in the form of God, he has taken something else, something in addition. He was made, to use the language of chapter 2, like his brothers. He's not ashamed to call us his brethren, and because we share in flesh and blood, he partook of the same things. So at a definitive moment in time, he clothes himself with our nature. It's very interesting to reflect on the argument of chapter 2 that Jesus did not take the nature of angels to himself. And yet the reason he took an additional nature at all was to destroy an angel. He came to destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil. So his business is the destruction of an angel. But to destroy the angel requires not that he takes on him the nature of angels, but the offspring of Abraham. So he becomes a man in order to destroy an angel. And he takes our weaknesses and is made like us in every respect, so that he will be a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God. Now, that's such an important idea, that his humanity is taken not as an end in itself, but as a means of service to enable him to fulfill the function of priesthood. The incarnation is not what saves. But without the incarnation, there can be no salvation. It's not his identity with us in his humanity that saves us. It's not the manger that saves us. The manger is a step down, but it's still at the top of the stairs. He has to keep walking down in the descent of his humiliation until at last he comes to the dereliction of Calvary. And Bethlehem is for Golgotha, and the incarnation is for the priesthood. And the reason a body has been prepared for him is precisely because of his servitude to God. So here he is now in the form of a servant. He is Jesus. He's going to save his people from their sins. He's not the only person who was ever called Jesus, but he's the only Jesus who is one person in two natures. And that body, in the language of chapter 10, as the writer quotes from Psalm 40, that body was prepared for him as the sign of his willing servitude. Now, it's very interesting. When Christ came into the world, he said, this is Hebrews 10:5, quoting from Psalm 40, verses 6 following, "Sacrifices and offerings you have not desired, but a body have you prepared for me." Now, of course, in the Hebrew of Psalm 40, it says, "You opened my ear," which I take to be a reference to the law of the slave in Exodus 21, who's offered his freedom but doesn't want to take it because he loves his master. So the law says, take that slave, put a hole in his ear, and the hole in his ear will be a sign that he is willing to serve his master for the whole of his life. He prefers the service of his master to the freedom that the law offers him in the seventh year. And yet now, the writer to the Hebrews takes up this psalm, but instead of quoting, "You opened my ear," he says, "You prepared a body for me." So there's a sense in which the incarnation is the evidence of Christ's willingness to be the servant of Jehovah. This is the equivalent of the opening of his ear. This is the statement that he is making, that he delights to do the will of the one who sent him. So he is the equal to the Father in every respect as to his deity. But in his humanity, he is stating, I'm willing to be the servant of the Father. And both of these things are true at the same time. I and the Father are one, and the Father is greater than I am. So the equality draws our attention to his deity, but the subordination is because he is the servant. He calls God his Father because he is the equal, but he calls his Father his God because he's the willing subordinate. So he's Jesus, the Son of God, and we bow before his majesty. That's who he is. But what is he? This one person with these two natures is a great high priest. That's what he is. He has a very specific function and a very specific office to fulfill. He cannot fulfill the function without being possessed of our nature in addition to his own underived nature. But in our nature, he fulfills the role, first of all, of a priest. Every priest, as we read in chapter 5, is called and appointed by God. So Christ, chapter 5, verse 5, did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed. So he's designated and called and set apart to that office. Jesus has a call to the ministry, and the call originates in God's eternal covenant and in God's purpose to save. He doesn't make himself a priest. He's appointed. He's appointed by God, taken, as chapter 5, verse 1 puts it, to act on behalf of men in relation to God. And it really is the most wonderful thing for a sinner like me to know that in every aspect of the business that there is between me and God, God has designated someone to act on my behalf. So that when it comes to my law breaking, my sin, my offending God, God has appointed someone to act on my behalf. I don't need to be my own priest. I don't need to offer God my own best. It has, in fact, nothing to do with what I can offer and everything to do with what he will offer. Hangs my helpless soul on thee. So everything that needs to be done between me and God is done for me. It's done for me by this priest. That's his calling, that's his office, that's his function. But it's not just that I have a priest. I've got a high priest. I've got a priest designated to make atonement, absolute atonement, to deal with every aspect of my sin and my guilt before God. So when my conscience offends me and accuses me, I've got someone who has the authority to be in the immediate presence of God, having shed his blood. And of course, the writer to the Hebrews is going to go on to explain how Christ is a high priest after the order of Melchizedek and so on, drawing all the time on the tabernacle imagery of the Old Testament, where the priest had to offer a sacrifice in the outer court of the tabernacle before the eyes of men, and then the high priest takes the blood that is shed there, goes through the veil, and sprinkles the mercy seat. And really, if the writer to the Hebrews, if the letter to the Hebrews is telling us anything, it's telling us that we need the Old Testament to understand the gospel and the fullness of the gospel. We need Melchizedek, for all that he appears just very briefly, for a fleeting moment in the book of Genesis, we need him to understand the uniqueness of the priesthood of Christ. We need the tabernacle too. We needed to realize that when Jesus said on the cross, "It is finished," he didn't actually mean "it is finished." What he did mean was that part of my priestly work that could only be done here is finished. So the same functionary, the same office bearer in the tabernacle officiates at two altars. He officiates at the altar of brass in the courtyard, the altar of bloodshed, before he then goes in to officiate at the altar of gold, the altar of incense, in the presence of God. He finishes his work at one altar, and if he doesn't finish it there, he can't officiate at the second. Until he's finished outside the veil, he can't go inside the veil. Unless he does what he has to do in the eyes of men and before men and in the presence of men, he cannot then do what he must do to continue his priesthood in the immediate presence of God. We have a high priest, not just a priest. We have someone who was given a task to do, to officiate at an altar in a public place, in a public arena before the eyes of a watching world. And when he said, "It is finished," he meant, all that I have to do here is finished. And now the work continues, as we'll see in a moment. He's making atonement in the immediate presence of God. So his was not the last cross on which people were crucified, but his cross was the last altar on which a sacrifice was necessary. So he appears now in the presence of God, not without blood. He's our high priest. But he's a great high priest. Nobody's going to step into his office after him, which is part of the reason we need Melchizedek to appear and disappear on the pages of history, without father or mother, without length of days. Christ is made a high priest according to the power of an endless life. It's a unique priesthood. He's a great high priest and brings the ceremony to a conclusion forever. So that's who he is. He is Jesus, the Son of God, and this is what he is. He's our great high priest. And then there's this emphasis on where he is, the theater of his operation now. No longer on a cross amid the shadows of earth, he has passed through the heavens. He came from the glory to officiate as a priest in our world, and he has left our world, still officiating as a priest, to continue officiating as a priest in another world. That's the panorama of this magnificent statement. He took our nature to be a priest. In our nature, he fulfilled the role of a priest. In our nature, he leaves the world as a priest, passing through the heavens as the great high priest, as the high priest in the Old Testament disappeared from view behind the curtain to officiate there. So our Savior passed through the heavens and is now at the right hand of the Majesty on high. And all the tribes of Israel on that great day of atonement, in all their different camps, in all their different positions around the tabernacle, all had their eyes fixed on this one functionary, this one solitary figure, this one individual designated to make atonement for them all. And so says the writer to every believer everywhere, in every denomination and in every nation and in every place in the world. This is the object of your attention too. And this is your great interest, that you have such a priest. Well, to what end is this person fulfilling his priesthood in that place? Well, for a twofold end. First of all, to encourage us to hold fast our confession. We have a confession. The writer is assuming that those who have the priest have the confession. It's the priest they confess. They are known as those who believe with the heart and who confess with the lips. I suppose that there are many who have a confession on the lips but no faith in the heart to match it. And there are certainly in some traditions those who have faith in the heart but no confession on the lips. But neither case is, according to Scripture, to be normative. The normative case is that where there is faith, there is a confession of faith. And Christ is my confession. I confess him. But because of what he's doing, where he's now situated, I have every reason to maintain that confession. That's the point. Let's hold it fast. Let's not just have it and make it, but let's hold it. We're tempted on every side to drop it, to compromise it, and in many ways to change it. But the writer says, because of what we have, let's hold it. And then he introduces this magnificent thought that what we don't have is just as important as what we do have. We don't have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness. We don't have that. Whatever we can say about Jesus, the Son of God, we can't say he doesn't know how weak I am. Making my confession and standing against the stream so often, mid-current, anti-current, and facing an onslaught and a barrage of criticism because I'm wanting to confess this Jesus with all his uniqueness in a pluralistic society and all his otherworldliness in a secular society, he's forgotten how weak I can be. The writer says, you can never say that. Jesus may be through the heavens and on the other side of the veil, but his memory has been perfected to the extent that he still remembers what it was like to be in the wilderness. He still remembers that his public ministry, inaugurated in a blaze of baptismal glory, was immediately launched with an attack by the very devil that he had come to destroy. He comes out of the waters of baptism into the waters of temptation. The voice that said, "This is my beloved Son," is now for 40 days nowhere to be heard. And the isolation of the desert contrasts so much with the grandeur of the moment of his baptism, with its revelation of God in Trinity, the Father God, unseen but heard, the Son God, seen and heard, the Spirit of God, seen and silent, and in that one great moment of apocalypse, God in Trinity is revealed as the Father baptizes the Son with the Spirit and prepares him for his task. But the blaze of light is soon lost, and the same Spirit leads him into the wilderness. We like the Spirit that comes down with power, but we're not so fond of the Spirit that leads us into the arena of testing. But the Spirit that empowered is the Spirit that leads Jesus into the wilderness. And the devil exploits all his human weaknesses, his hunger, his tiredness, the possibility of his crucifixion, tempts him to take shortcuts to glory, uses his human nature to attack his divine nature and his divine identity, if you are the Son of God, Jesus. And tries to exploit all the weaknesses that belong to him in our humanity to attack all the strengths that belong to him in his divinity. It's a great moment of testing. But it was good that he suffered when tempted, says chapter 2, because he's able to help those who are tempted. And so the devil comes to me, as the Spirit ordains testing moments for me. And the devil's given room to exploit my weaknesses. If you are the Son of God, if you're the daughter of God, then surely it's okay for you to do this. If your sins are forgiven, then surely it's okay for you to do that. In the same way, exploiting our weaknesses. And the devil's interest is that we won't hold our confession, that we'll betray our confession in a moment of weakness. The exhortation is, let's hold our confession, because we don't have a priest who was not tempted. He sympathizes with our weaknesses, because in every respect, he was tempted as we are. So as one writer put it, God had one son without sin, but no sons without temptation. And the temptations he faced were as broad as the temptations we face. In their nature, exactly the same. Even in the different world of a first century wilderness, Jesus is tempted and tested as we are in our modern 21st century age. That's a breathtaking thought. I have no doubt at all that the wilderness was not the only temptation, period, in the life of the Lord. But the concentration of the devil's efforts at the very beginning of his ministry are a remarkable indication of the Lord's sympathy with our weaknesses, because he's tempted and yet he's got no sin. Now, when the writer tells us that Jesus was tempted without sin, he's saying more than that he didn't yield. He is saying that he could not yield. He's drawing our attention to the fact that not only did he not sin after he was tempted, but he could not sin even before he was tempted. And going into the temptation, it was not possible that he would sin. Now, I have no difficulty at all in balancing these two things: the reality of the Lord's impeccability and the reality of the Lord's temptation. That he could not sin in no way suggests that he could not be tempted. In fact, it makes the liability to temptation even greater, because he has to hold his ground not simply until the temptation is gone, but until the tempter himself is gone. I mean, Adam, the first Adam, in a garden, surrounded with all the insignia of divine blessing and favor, he is tempted. The temptation is soon gone. The temptation is gone when he yields to it and he sins. But the last Adam, in a wilderness with no apparent evidences of God's favor, he waits his ground, stands his ground, not yielding, but beating the tempter in the arena and in the contest. Who feels the pain of the weights most in the strong man's contest? Two men side by side, and they're both holding up the weights to see which of them is the stronger. Who feels the pain most? Is it the person who drops the weights first? Or the person who holds his ground until the contest is over? That's the one who feels the pain. And this Christ feels the pain of temptation precisely because of his impeccability, his being without sin, his inability to yield to sin, makes the temptation all the more harrowing. And at last, even the temptation not to go to the cross, all the more testing. Be this far from you, Lord. To which his immediate response is, get behind me, Satan. So let's hold our confession. Weak as we are, poor as we are, feeble as we are, afraid as we are, our man on the other side of the curtain remembers what it was like to live on this side of the curtain. He's gone to the world of the living, but he's not forgotten what it was like to be in the world of the dying. In the sinless perfection of glory, he's been in the devil's arena, and so too will you be, and so too will I be. But the Christ we confess is every reason that we need to hold our confession. And then there's this, I'm conscious that the time is going, but there's this second exhortation too. Let's come with boldness to the throne of grace. Here we are, and there he is. In our needs and in our temptations and our testing times and our weaknesses, he can come to us. He helps us when we are tempted, sympathizes in our weakness, strengthens us in it. He comes to us. But the second exhortation here is this: let's go to him. Let's go to the place where the priest is enthroned. He's a king priest. That's why we need Melchizedek to know what a king priest looks like. To him belongs sovereignty, not just ministry. He's the Lamb, but he's the Lamb in the midst of the throne. One day that throne will be a throne of judgment, but his presence, as our priest, as Calvin puts it, turns the throne of God's terrible holiness into a throne of grace. So let's come to the throne of grace. Let's come to it with boldness. It's an interesting Greek word there. It's a word that the classical Greek orators prized very highly. They regarded this as the highest rights of the citizen of the Greek city to be able to speak freely. Freedom of speech. That's the idea in the word that's translated confidence or boldness. Freedom of speech. You can come to the throne of grace and say anything. You can use words if you have to, but you can come and say anything. You've got that freedom before God. Whatsoever you ask in my name, I will do it. Now, I have to confess that I don't fully understand these words because the breadth of them is so immense. We talk so much, don't we, about us doing God's will, knowing God's will, following God's will. And yet, the occupant of heaven's throne says to us, I want to know your will. I'm prepared to do your will. Whatsoever you ask in my name, I will do it. So you come with boldness. Now, the fact that he doesn't give us everything we ask for is itself a remarkable token of his gentleness and his kindness in dealing with us. Sometimes we ask amiss. Sometimes we ask, as Psalm 66 puts it, while we're still regarding and considering sin in our hearts. Sometimes we ask, and what we're looking for, as James puts it, we're going to spend on our lusts. But still, I can't get away from the sheer breadth and glory of Christ's statement to the disciples in the upper room. Whatever you ask in my name, I will do it. So freedom of speech, with anything, at any time, in any place, any burden, take it to the throne of grace. Take it to the Lord in prayer. And take it there because you're guaranteed two things. You're guaranteed at the throne of grace that you'll receive mercy. That, like Esther, you'll find the king's scepter outstretched and a token of your acceptance and your right to come. And at the throne of grace, you'll find grace. There's an interesting distinction, isn't there, between mercy and grace. Mercy means that God does not give us what we deserve. He doesn't deal with us as we deserve. People sometimes say at tragic funerals, you know, he didn't deserve that. He didn't deserve what happened to him. She didn't deserve that. As if that was a bad thing. It's a good thing. It's a good thing that we don't get what we deserve. Because God is a God of mercy. He doesn't give us what we deserve. If he did, then we would be of all men most miserable. The corollary is that he gives us grace. Not just that he doesn't give us what we do deserve, that's mercy. But he does give us what we don't deserve. That's grace. But he doesn't say, here's a package labeled mercy. That's for you. Here's a package labeled grace. This is for you. Sinclair Ferguson has a line somewhere where he says, there is no such thing as grace. Meaning, there is no thing that you get in your hand and you can look at and measure it. That's grace. Grace is simply Christ in all the glory of his saving power given to us to help us in our time of need. So in our weaknesses, he comes to us. In our times of need, we can go to him. In a moment, in an instant, in any way, with any burden, and he will give us measured grace. Not to take the burden away. Paul discovered that sometimes you ask for things to be taken away, and God says, I think it's better for you if I leave the difficulty where it is, I'm not going to take away the thorn, but I will give you sufficient grace to bear it. So that's our possession. We've got a great high priest. Let's maintain our confession. And let's exercise the right that he has bestowed upon us to speak freely in the king's court and to know that for today his grace will be as sufficient as our need is manifest.